Okay, well, let's get our official start here with a prayer, and then I'll tell you where I hope to go with all this today. Would somebody please have a prayer for us? Okay, what I thought probably would be the best way to handle today's class is have you do your presentations first and talk about them, then do Haddon Robinson, and then I have the things I want to introduce for you that I'd like you to read for Monday and Wednesday, that I'll get to those and tell you about them. They're three readings from different sources. I like this idea of taking Friday as much as I can and getting some kind of speaking practice, delivery practice. That's obviously going to go up and accelerate as we go along. In particular, we have full sermons to give, and then I want to see if you can improve them and give them again. So that worked for me once in a public speaking class very well when final speeches were able to be given and then reworked and given again. People seem to learn a lot doing that and enjoy doing that. And so that's how we'll be handling the two big sermons here.
So we're going to just originate and write one sermon and do it twice. Or we're going to
two sermons given twice. But some of the other things I was thinking about doing for this kind of practice, and I was thinking for maybe next Friday, if you might want to start thinking about it, would be a children's sermon of sorts, a short little children's sermon. I think that's a real challenge and one you might be likely to be handed at some point, and it's difficult. I was thinking about even getting Vicky, my wife, who gave a lot of little children's talks at one point in a church and got pretty good at seeing if she would want to talk about it, although she teaches at the same period, so I don't know how I'll get her to do that, but I might be gleaning her for insights. I've seen really good children's presentations and really bad ones, you know, where the kids weren't paying attention at all. It was sort of the duty of marching them up front and getting to talk to them. But other ones I've seen have been really, really well done. It's hard not to be artificial when you're talking to kids. I don't think that works well. Some people get overly cute. Anyway, I was thinking that might be an interesting presentation issue to work on. I'm thinking maybe next Friday. And it would be a short one again, you know, a five to 10 minute kind of presentation. But one of the special kinds of preaching assignments right up there with weddings and funerals. I know some homiletics classes, particularly in as much as they're seminary-based and training ministers, that would be a big thing. I'm not sure that needs to play a part here in this class so much. I mean, perhaps we could do that. I don't know. Would you like to give a funeral sermon? You just have gone through a funeral.
I did a devotional.
Did you? At the funeral?
Yeah.
Oh, how long was it?
I didn't have time, but I kind of wrote it last minute because I was doing schoolwork while I was home, too. I was like 5 minutes, 7 minutes. Like, a lot of times whenever I'm doing them, I can write it and then run it. But then when I get up there, it never is the same time that I get whenever I run it, because I'll think of stuff and add more comments in and not say the same thing I have written down sometimes. Like the same idea, but not the same exact words. So it was probably 5 to 7 minutes or something.
That may be a principle to keep in mind. I have very tightly scripted messages for the most part in sermons, but I've found they are longer. I mean, I do take the liberty of going off the page, so if I time something in my bedroom practicing, you know, see that it's 18 minutes long, I think in reality this is going to turn into at least 20 minutes and maybe even up to 25. It just depends on how much I feel stockpiled in there. And I think that's good. It's not a Secretary of State who has to measure their words so tightly that if they get off the page, I know that with politicians, when politicians go past their speech writers, everybody gets nervous. What are they going to say? Don't ad lib. But I think for a preacher, it's a different matter altogether. How did you find that experience speaking at a funeral?
It was good. I mean, it was somewhat different because it was my grandfather was a family member. So, I mean, I don't know. I feel like emotionally it would have been very different than, like, a pastor who they know somebody from the congregation, but they're not family. But, I mean, overall it was good. Like, I did it on 1 Corinthians 15, and chapter 6 in the book, he uses a section of scripture from that to talk about one kind of, like, deductive sermon.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, the guy who whose sermon outline he took had very, very definitely A, B, C, B points, and I definitely, like, I made points, but it wasn't like, but I don't know, for a devotional, like how does that play in if it's a devotional compared to like a full-blown sermon, or doesn't that make any difference?
I think the lines are all kind of blurry, you know, where we do one of these little 5-minute exercises versus a, you know, a 30-minute sermon. I mean, much of the same stuff is true. Funerals are very, I was always been a pastor of a small church, so I didn't get to do a lot of weddings and funerals, but the few that I've done, I've found that people have responded very kindly, and they appreciate, I think, the declaration of the gospel, the hope of life, the comfort that comes from a funeral sermon. They respond well to it. I've been surprised, because often you preach, especially if you preach a lot, and you may hear a few comments, you know, somebody liked it or didn't like it. But for the most part, you just have to go without a lot of feedback. But it seems to me when I've done funerals, it's actually been a lot of feedback. And it's usually been very gratifying, because it mattered to somebody that you were there in that role doing that, making that declaration. I mean, it's a stressful situation, even for distant relatives. And I found it is difficult, though. I mean, I have actually spoken for people who are close to me, but the funerals I did were generally people they weren't family members, but a couple of them were hard situations. They were people who died too young in tragic deaths, and so that everybody there was slightly rattled by it. Very interesting.
I was just a little while ago, back in the fall semester, I think it was, I went home, but I had known real well. There's a 20, he was 20 year old, he was killed in a car accident. And I went to his funeral. And the sermon, I mean, it was long. I was like, okay, this, we've gone. And, I mean, it was good. It was a good sermon, but it was very lengthy. And when you said about dying, you know, you always had that thought, well, that's not fair, and it's not, you know. He made a good analogy, though. I mean, it doesn't change the fact that, you know, he said, okay, when you think about it, he made the comparison, okay, say 100, say like a million years or something is from here to the moon or something, and, you know, we think, okay, 100 years. You can barely see 100, you know, and 20 years, there's no difference. And, I mean, it is a good point. It kind of,
well, yeah, it puts things in perspective.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think it was, like, rude in any way saying, and get over it, but I don't know, it helps us think, well, life is short in general. But I just thought it was interesting.
These are all interesting things. Well, I don't know. Maybe we should have a funeral exercise, a devotional exercise on that level. But I'm thinking children's sermon for next week, but we'll talk about that then at the beginning of the week and see maybe what the elements are. If we can't get enough information about doing that together or feel comfortable with it, we'll do something else and go from there. At this point, I think I want to hear from you. Remember our assignment from Matthew 12 and kind of making one point, I was calling it a sermonette. I think some people would find that an insulting term, but I don't think you need to be insulted by that. I said, picture yourself in front of 200 people. Don't think of it as an informal little group where you're having a chat, but a place where you'll have to hold forth. I'm thinking, think of a formal congregational setting. Think of this as a pulpit. You certainly aren't anchored to it if you don't want to be, but it depends on how you want to communicate. You always notice how I pull this little bookcase away from here. That's so I can get out either side of this, but also because I think these things send messages. Most pulpits these days are small, and I've done a lot of preaching from music stands and things like that. It gives you kind of a full body of visual of the person speaking, therefore they can use all their body motion deliberately. These kinds of things are formidable. They say importance. I say these are the 1950s keep the communist out pulpits. They're authoritarian. I don't like them for the most part. I think they're old fashioned, and I think they at one time probably sent the right signal, but I don't think they do now. I think they make a speaker unapproachable. The more debris you have between you the first few rows of people you're speaking to, I think it's creating a psychological distance. I've talked a little about rooms in public speaking classes. It really varies congregation to congregation what kind of situation you'll be speaking in. Do all your churches have raised platforms? Do they have like formidable pulpits? You know, and the preacher usually gets up and stands behind the thing. Some of the Anglican ones I was around, you know, there really wasn't a lot of room to maneuver. I mean, you kind of walked up steps to get in them, and there wasn't really a whole lot of room to be anything except from the waist up if you were gesticulating or moving. But of course, you see these other ones now where people are walking up and down stages. So the important thing, of course, is to control your own frame, control your space, and give confidence in it. One of the problems I've found speaking, I was invited to speak to youth a few years ago, and it was in a theater setting. And I think that establishes a completely different contract in the mind of the listener. They think of movies, plays, places where you've paid your admission and you take this on your own term. You have your own little padded seat there. You sit in the dark, and it creates a remarkable sense of independence from what's going on. Your ability to engage or disengage really affects things. And I think that's one of the most difficult situations to preach or teach in as a Christian, is a kind of a standard theater setting with theater seats, a stage, and a darkened room. Because people do disengage, and it's very hard to read them. Often the lights are blinding, and you only see a few empty rows up front. There may be 300 people there, but you're not really able to do anything but pretend you're making eye contact with them. Those can be difficult situations. So what I picture here, I picture just sort of a standard congregation. It's just 200 or 300 people, a pulpit maybe up front, not a huge platform, but a small platform. Think of standard pews. I don't know how it is in your congregations. I'm guessing the first few rows don't fill up. Is that true? Really? People sit all the way up to the front?
Not the very, very front, but the next one back.
Really?
See, churches I went to, it's like, they have that whole deacon board and all that stuff. So it's, people are in front, but it's just specifically reserved for deaconesses and those people. So
why do they put them up front?
I have no idea, honestly. I mean, I guess it's supposed to be there. I don't know. Just something that I've always seen.
Yeah.
Like deaconesses and deacons and the elders and those people. They sit in the front row, so you're not actually allowed to sit. And it's one of those unspoken things, like if you sat there. If you sat there and you were sitting there, and it's like somebody would like probably come and like, hey.
If you could move back a little bit.
A little, like.
Oh, so it's not during the section, but it's just the front row is basically reserved.
Yeah.
I went to one very like African-American church in Mobile, Alabama. It was a big congregation, I would think, 300-400 people were there, and they put the deacons in front. But I think one of the reasons they did that was because of the way they did the offering. The offering came up, they put little pedestals with baskets in maybe like four places, and a deacon was behind each basket, and then people brought their offering forward and went back. It wasn't one of these pass the basket things. And so I kind of maybe assumed they were up there because then they could take care of the offering really quickly.
But then there are also people who are in charge of the offering, so they come up and they hold it back in. So it's like, I don't know, it's just, and it's not even that, just that church, a lot of African American church, they fall into like some of that Baptist Presbyterian like thing, and I noticed that Baptists do that a lot. And they do the whole deaconesses and deacons and whatever else status sits in the front. And if you are like the mass choir and stuff like that, like they sit in certain sections. And then like I think about the fifth or sixth row is when like regular
the normal, the regular people show up. What's very interesting, I always, with public speaking, say do room reconnaissance. It really helps you to understand who you're speaking to, because you want to speak to a whole room. You want to be loud enough. You want to be visible to them. You want to, in a sense, see what you're up against in terms of a room. And so I try to take note of that. If the deacons are in the front row, then what will that mean? In the old revival meetings and things, what, you had the worrier's bench? not warriors, you know, the worry bench was it called, where people who were struggling emotionally with whether they were yielding to your message would come and fret. And then there was the standard amen corners in some churches. We've seen those, worked for those. The sort of off to your right and left. I'd never been in around church architecture like that when I'd become my own background. I wasn't in a lot of churches, but a Mennonite was telling me about the amen corners in his church to the left and right. And they were amen corners because the extra faithful apparently sat up in this area. The people who were really engaging were often these wings off to the left and right of the speaker. Then, of course, that gives you a challenge if you're speaking to a whole room. You have to break contact a little bit more.
When you look around, you see the expression on the face. It's like, oh, now I'll hold my hair again.
Okay, well, let's see what we do with our presentations now.
I'll let you go in whatever order you like to go. I think probably what would be best is maybe we should just go through all three of them and then discuss them. That way it won't feel quite so like you're under the loop being studied so quite so closely. Does that sound good to you all?
Yeah.
Okay, well, pretend the deacon or the pastor, whoever it is, has just called you up front, so you don't have a lot of time to butter up the crowd or anything, but get right to the point. Remember I said about podium approach and things like that. Whoever would like to go first? This was flashing behind you when you were speaking, but you handled it well. You don't allow distractions like that to stop you. What's that?
Just thinking, when there's distractions, that is something that's hard, you know, to figure out what, I mean, you keep going, but there was once when I was doing an opening, I was moderating, and I was going this style of devotional from the beginning, and there's a woman who's sitting, like, in the third row from the front, in the middle aisle, and I'm not sure what happened, but she, like, started crying and sobbing, and, like, the pastor's wife was sitting beside her, and, like, saying, God, off, and it was a scene, kind of, and they got up and walked back, and I'm like, look, now, and, like, you're observing this is like, well, you just keep going, and it was very.
It's really hard to know what to do in those kind of situations. I mean, I think if a truck goes by or a plane goes over and wipes you out, it would probably be better to stop and start again if the noise level went down. Yeah. If children are acting up in a sermon, it's very delicate because you don't want to put the parents on the spot by calling attention to it or even pausing. Just a few weeks ago, we had one really cutting loose in our congregation. It was distracting me, but I really felt like the best situation there was to keep talking, knowing, of course, that other people were probably having the same reaction and that maybe I would have to gently say the same thing a second time, but you don't want to put somebody on the spot like that. I've had people pass out while I was preaching. That was not because of my preaching. There was an older woman once who just keeled over. She fainted, and that was peculiar. We actually stopped on that one. There was nothing to do. Actually, paramedics came to the church and came in and worked with her. But it's such a difficult call to know what to do with distraction like that. I think you did the right thing in this case. If it's just a flashing screen or a technical issue like that, you should keep going. Most people will be able to not let it derail them too much. Okay, well, we'll come back and talk about yours, but let's listen to another one here. Oh, thanks, Brad. That was an interesting development of linking the passages like that. Said the chapters and verses of the Bible are man-made devices, and ideas straddle them in ways that are pretty intriguing. So I felt like you speak very fluidly as well. Work there. See how it's difficult to get your introduction and conclusion, and you have such a short little window. That's one of the hardest kinds of speaking arrangements to me, to be given just a little shot at something. Lots of writing, you know, lots of writing on it, but I mean, you don't have any time to really ad lib or correct course or do certain things. You have to kind of do it right the first time. If you have 30 minutes to speak and you feel like you really mangled a point, you can probably, if you're confident enough, take another stab at it, as long as you're not testing your audience's patience with that. It'll just seem like you're trying to elaborate on it, and they don't get the feeling like they don't have to hear the
text in your head and say, no, I didn't quite get that across, I'd better try again. They're just thinking, no, it's emerging, and he's helping me let it come to light. Angie.
Hey. Would you like to reflect on the experience of what that was like to do that?
I'm nervous.
You were nervous?
No, I'm nervous than was the last, and I'm like imagining this 2, 3, 4 to me. It's like,
it does put you, a big group does put you on the spot. I've preached to pretty big groups, and for a couple of years I was in a church planting, you know, where it might be 8 or 12 people in a living room. But it's just as much work, but there is a kind of pressure when you have to speak to a bigger group of people. There's no question. It's not exactly the same. Other comments on the experience here?
Seems kind of challenging to, like, use the same passage. I mean, you keep finding new stuff with it. Part of me felt like I was just rehashing the same thing, and I was trying not to do that, but I guess, I don't know. I mean, in theory, you wouldn't be doing a bunch of different stuff with the same thing, but, I mean, like, have you ever kind of ran into that, where you preach through something so many times, that it's like, you're learning new things, but as far as how
to say it. No, you know, I haven't really run into that so much. One of the reasons I've picked this Matthew 12 passage, I think it's rich, for one thing. I mean, it's got a lot of layers in it. It's got a story, and it's got some teaching, and there's some tension in it. It's a challenging kind of passage, and it leaves some things mysterious. I like that. But the whole idea of having the same passage and going over it is just to see how rich a passage like that is, and how a preacher's job is to jump inside that and really explore it. Assume the preacher is exploring that more deeply than the congregation is out in front of them. So I kind of want it to yield its treasures and secrets to us. We could jump off of it here. I don't mean to tax you with it, but we'll have to assume that, of course, we've all been here, but if you were speaking to a congregation, we'd just pretend it was a new congregation. they hadn't heard you speaking on it last week. Other comments on it?
I mean, I don't know. More of, I need ample amount of time, well, not ample, but significant time to prepare for it, even for a short thing, to just go through it. I mean, I can ad-lib a little bit on, on the spot, but sometimes, and I felt like when I was up there, I could have made more eye contact, but sometimes when I was looking off, maybe seemingly into space or something, like, I can search for words. If I'm searching for words, I don't, look at people directly in the eyes once I look somewhere else. And anyway, I guess where I was going with that was, I didn't prepare as much for it as I would normally. But that plays a big, obviously, a big part in being confident with what you have to say and trying to make it flow good and knowing what's coming next, so to speak, without searching through your notes or anything.
Searching for words can actually be kind of effective. It puts a kind of tension in the room. As long as you don't try the patience of the congregation with it too many times, but if you clearly are reaching for something and trying to it gives the sense that, well, there's a kind of excitement to it. It puts some tension in there. There's resolution. You got it out. You said it well. If you don't push that too far, you're in good shape. I remember once in the one congregation, one of the places where I first started really preaching formally, they surveyed us all as to how many hours it was taking us to prepare a sermon for Sundays, how much time that took us. And they ranged from, I think, 20 hours down to 5. I think I found that 12 to 15 hours is what it took for me back then. Now, it would be a little bit different now, because if you're in that role and you're constantly reading the scriptures and preaching a lot, it's sort of like you're in shape. It's as if you were a runner. A runner who's training can go out and run a 10K race tomorrow, probably. They don't need all that much preparation for it in that sense. I mean, they'll get ready for a big race. But they're always in shape. They're always training. They're always at it. It's always working with them. But if you were not a runner, and you said, we want you to run in a 10K race next month, you'd have to start getting out there and training a lot. And I think that's how it is when you're an occasional preacher. It takes a lot more time. But it's hard to say how long it takes somebody to develop a sermon. It varies a little. I still take quite a bit of time with them. I need a lot of prep. I'm not a good extemporaneous speaker for the most part, and I just don't feel called to do my preaching that way. You can get stuck, though. You say, you know, I need somebody to speak tomorrow. I've been called in for sick pastors and stuff Sunday morning. It's happened. We're in trouble. Can you come? Yeah, I can. I have old sermon outlines and things. I can pray about it and work with it. If you don't keep those kind of records, you may be in a little more trouble.
I was going to say, do you keep a file? Because I've heard people talk about that. Like, that's just in general advice. Like, keep sermon illustrations, keep a file of old sermons. I mean,
since I often use written scripts or outlines, I keep those and have them online, so there are lots of places I can dig them out and work with. I remember my associate pastor in Alabama, I think he had a couple sermons outlined in the back of his Bible. He had end pages, and he put a few very simple outlines. If somebody calls me to preach out of the blue, and they were basic evangelical messages, I think, you know, come to Christ and a Romans Road kind of speech or something like that. And I thought, that might not be a bad thing to have in your Bible. I know our students who were in Africa said that, you know, they were put on the spot to preach, you know, get up and say a few words. That happened to me in Spanish once. I was called right out of the congregation to get up and start talking. Not only was it on the spot, but it was in a not my native tongue. It's quite a challenge. Okay, when I look down through this, I think, do you consider your presentations, would you have thought of those as deductive or inductive?
I was trying to be inductive. I really don't like to do the deductive approach, but I think I was somewhat in there, deductive, with some things.
Before I answer that, what did you guys, how would you appraise your approach? Was it deductive or inductive?
I think mine seemed more inductive, I guess, because I was asking, like, what's he looking for? Asking him questions and looking around, and then, oh, I found something here. And, I mean, I think he's a,
What do you say?
I guess I kind of stated the subject right at the beginning. God's desire for the Sabbath is a focus on Him and loving what He loves. So that would probably be, because I said that. And then, I don't know, when I think of a deductive sermon, I always think of something a little more tight than that. Like, I was trying to keep coming back to it, but when I think deductive, I'll think, like, point A,
right.
Point two.
Yeah, none of you were in strict deductive form. I would say you all had hybrids. You all worked with a lot of rhetorical questions. What's that?
If they just read some chapter said there's either deductive, semi-deductive, or inductive. Or something
inductive,
like
yeah. It's beginning of chapter 7.
Is it? Yeah, I've been reading so many of these books now, I can't remember exactly what's ahead of us in Robinson real clearly on the spur of the moment, but I'd say you were sort of in between. If I were thinking of a thing, Andrew was probably the most inductive, especially say, what's the temple? I like that. It was a very creative use of the passage, and I didn't think did any violence to it at all. I felt that was very useful. I'd say you were probably the least inductive, Zach, least inductive, because you used the technical points more than anyone else, talking about your word studies and things like that. But you had several rhetorical questions, and I think when you start asking rhetorical questions, you're moving into inductive territory. One thing I would suggest with that is if you deliver a rhetorical question, feature it very strongly. You know, what does this mean? Pause, deliver it real deliberately, and give a pause afterwards. Like, you really expect the person sitting there to take a second and say, what is my answer? And they're not going to shout it out loud. I mean, maybe they will. I don't know. But give them a chance. So deliver your rhetorical questions with real, I think, deliberation. And don't use too many of them. One or two of them will really, really be a powerful thing. You all had them in there. I really liked them. I thought you did good use of them. Conclusions, I think Angie probably had the strongest conclusion. Zach, you faded out a little bit at the end of yours. I thought you were very strong, and then the end didn't come to me right away. I thought, oh, okay, that's good. But you were fine. As I said, this is a very difficult assignment in some ways like this. I thought you all used the scriptures well. I enjoyed that. So far we've done a technical point, how to put a technical point into a message, and now we've had a complete message built around a short passage, a little devotional. You said an opening. I've seen that in some Mennonite churches where Sunday school, they send up a superintendent or somebody who kind of elaborates on the passage all the Sunday schools will do. That seems a very Mennonite-ish thing to do to me. Is that how your church does it?
Not anymore. I think long ago Bethel does that.
United Bethel, over here.
But it's not, they don't necessarily follow the Sunday school text system. Mm.
But it's a kind of a pre-assembly, and you don't get, it's not a whole sermon. Yeah. You get to. Well, good. As I said, we'll keep working with little exercises before we get to that. Okay, I wanted to look at Robinson. Yeah, Angie, do you have a question?
I was a little nervous about putting the whole brother back or whatever. Like, I feel like, I don't know, I was thinking I would have to know somebody if I'm invited to speak at a church. So I figured, like, maybe Dale or one of the brothers, and you would be the pastor or whatever. So I'm not sure if that's something, not even just this, but like to use in the future if I were to be asked in that way.
Well, you have to be careful. There would be people who would be mortified. I mean, they just don't want attention called to themselves, or they might think you're leaning on them specifically. Like, what sin about, what temple of Icon building? What does she know about me, for heaven's sake? Pastors and deacons might be fair game, though, because they're used to the analysis of their public figures. But you would want to think about it. If you do call attention to a timid person, a private person, you may be violating their space a little bit. But I liked it. I liked it how you did it here. Your palms didn't start to sweat, I don't suppose. It was kind of a non-threatening question. I felt like it was a very, very good point.
If you're in, I mean, it's like, oh, this is really personal. You call my name. And, I mean, not the rhetorical question, but,
Well, I see that we're running out of time here. I hate to do this, but I'm thinking we might have to put off chapter 4 yet once again to talk about it. Maybe just let's get started with it and come back to it. I don't think we'll get very far. But once again, I just go through, I underline the things that matter to me. Stages in the development of messages. Now we're on analyzing the exegetical idea more than anything. I underlined the very first page there, 73. Expositors must be involved in three different worlds: the world of the Bible, the modern world, and the particular world in which we are called to preach. Well, that's a good idea. You're not just delivering a message objectively into the ether. You're speaking in a context, and to know, understand the contexts involved, the Bibles, the world of the Bible, for example, the modern world. I mean, where do we all sit in the modern world, and where in particular does that congregation sit, seems like a good idea. And then he elaborates on this on the next page, 74, middle of the first paragraph. We must first try to understand what the revelation of God meant for the men and women to whom it was originally given. This is a very fundamental point to the grammatical historical Bible interpretation I've told you about that most evangelicals would adopt. Now, it doesn't answer every question about the scripture. There are lots of things that you need to add to it to make it work. But as a tool, it does say, now in this text, the most responsible way to approach it is, how did the original author see that situation in the scripture? There's a context within a context. If John's looking back at the pool of Bethesda, he may be sitting in Ephesus 50 years later, looking back at an event in a country that his reader hasn't gone to. So you've got double context there. And then the reader's got to go through him back to that context. How did they hear it? And so there's a lot of complexity in trying to establish, you might say, what did it mean for the men and women to whom it was originally given? It's wrapped, right? A story is within a story is within a story, and you've got lots of layers going on there. The second world we consider is the modern world. We must be aware of the current swirling across our times. I feel that this is one deficiency I've noted in a lot of the Mennonite preaching I've had, is it does not take note of what's going on in the world very well. I think they're probably afraid of being accused, that old idea of preaching from the headlines or giving political opinions, but nonetheless, things are happening in this world, and I think situating our message in light of that's a good idea. The third world, this is the last full paragraph there, which we must participate in, is our own particular world. And then he goes on to, the Bible speaks of the gift of the pastor-teacher. This implies the two functions should be joined, and elaborates on this a little bit. And then, top of 75, in the following stages, we endeavor to bring the ancient world, the modern world, and our particular world together as we develop the sermon. So we'll pause there on 75, we'll get to stage 4 there. I have some readings I want you to do, and I'm going to suggest an order. These come from websites, and I've all of them, I think, are legitimate. They're worth considering. Now, the first one is, what can preachers learn from Billy Graham? It comes from preaching.com, and it's not a bad little article, although I will probably pick at it a little bit when we get there. This fellow teaches homiletics at New Orleans Baptist Theological Seminary. He's not a lightweight. So what preachers can learn from Billy Graham? I would read this one first. Okay, now the next one I have, I found actually was a generalized Google search, but it was what I was looking for. And this will be surprising at a Mennonite college in the sense that it comes from a military chaplain. But I like the way the guy writes, and I like what he has to say about classical rhetoric and its use in sermons. I would read it second, because it's a little lighter introduction to these things. So, preaching and communication. Now, the third article that I brought is the one I would read last. It's probably going to be the hardest to wade through, and perhaps surprisingly too, it's from a Catholic source. It's from Michael Dominic O'Connor, and it comes from Homiletic and Pastoral Review, which is a Catholic journal on preaching. Now, I'm not a Roman Catholic, and there will be things in here that, of course, I would probably once, just like with the military chaplain, might step back from. But yet, I think he does a very good job of tying us into that tradition, seeing some of the things that come from Augustine there. So I'd read this one last. It's a little bit heavier sledding, but it's not a hard read by any means. So, when we get here Monday, let's try to get through Haddon's book, finally. And let's try to read these. And we've got listening assignments coming up. Did we say we were going to do those Mondays or Wednesdays at this point?
Oh, the sermon.
Yeah, the sermon evaluation. Will you be ready?
I said on Monday.
I thought I was trying to move it back to Monday, but maybe that's a little soon if we've got all this on our plate. Perhaps we should think of those sermon evaluations Wednesday next week and then keep moving them back. We've been doing them on Friday, that's right. Oh, I'm sorry, I was thinking backwards. Well, I don't know what to do about that.